Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And here in New York, we had some mighty thunderstorms this morning, but the sun is trying to break through right now, and it's looking like a beautiful day. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on in the world and in our country. We have had a lot of rules being handed down by the Supreme Court this week. That is not very good for liberals. abortion rights is being challenged. Separation of families is being challenged. The ban on immigration is being challenged. Unions, whether you need to participate in paying up if you want to be a member or not, that's being challenged. There's so many different things being decided right now. And then with yesterday's announcement that Supreme Court Justice Kennedy is going to be stepping down, allowing President Trump to appoint another Supreme Court justice to the bench that will impact our decisions for decades to come, is just a really scary, scary thought. And so it's really important for all of us, as always, to get involved, and it's more important than ever. You can start by this weekend. There's marches around the country, a huge march in Washington, D.C. They're calling it the End Family Separation March. It's also hashtag Families Belong Together March. A huge one in Washington, D.C. There's one in New York City this weekend. There's even one here on Long Island in Westbury. But it's really important that we get involved. We need to let our representatives know that the majority of Americans do not support this immigration policy. We do not support the un-American way that we are welcoming refugees into this country, or not welcoming refugees into this country at all. There are just so many issues at hand right now. It is just really scary. So some of the ways that you can get involved are, like I said, showing up at the marches and rallies this weekend on Saturday, June 30th. There is a volunteer mobilization taking place at Hofstra University to get people to vote. It's being sponsored by Planned Parenthood, but getting people out to vote is crucial no matter what the issue is you're getting them out to vote for. We just need to get more Democrats registered and voting, even in the Democratic primary. I mean, this year we actually have Cynthia Nixon trying to unseat Governor Cuomo for the Democratic nominee position. And learning more about what Cynthia Nixon is about is really crucial as well. But I know that she is standing up for fracking, or meaning standing up to get us off of fossil fuels and undo the infrastructure for fracking plants and pipelines and all that stuff that Governor Cuomo has not been able to get behind. Even though he says he's against fracking, in his actions, that is not what we are seeing. So it is important that we all get out to vote, and you have an opportunity on July 10th, if you're in the Long Island, New York area, to join a volunteer mobilization summit. There's two different sessions at Hofstra. There's one from 9:30 to 11:30, and then one in the evening from 6 to 8 p.m. You can find out more information about it on my website, or if you go to Planned Parenthood of Nassau County, you can find out more information about that there as well. There's a great art show taking place now through November 11th at Storm King Art Center. It's artists responding to climate change, and it's a unique exhibit that's exploring climbing temperatures, rising sea levels, how climate change is impacting our world. And there's 17 contemporary artists showing in this show. If you haven't been to Storm King before, it's a beautiful outdoor sculpture garden. You can just spend hours walking the fields and coming upon one beautiful sculpture after another. So you might want to check that out. You have some time, but it's really worthwhile. Pick a nice day and bring a picnic. It's really great. Tomorrow night, June 29th, NOFA New York is having their farm-to-table dinner up in Locust Grove in Poughkeepsie. And there's varying prices to participate. So check out the NOFA New York website to find out more information about that. If you would like to join in on a climate leader training that former Vice President Al Gore is running in the end of August coming up, it's called the Climate Reality Project. And he is doing a training August 28th to 30th in the L.A. area. You can find out information about that also on my website or go to the Climate Reality Leadership Corps website and find out more information. But we need more people to join in and become climate change leaders. Like I was saying, we all need to figure out where we can fit in to let our voices be heard and to become active participants in the situation that's going on right now in our country. We can't just stand back and think that somebody else is going to take care of it, because these decisions are going to be affecting us for decades, and we have children and grandchildren and animals and just the environment. They need to be protected by people that care. And unfortunately, the people in office right now are not caring. So please get involved. July 11th and July 12th, there is a screening of a wonderful documentary called Pesticides in Paradise, How Hawaiian Communities Took on the Chemical Industry and Won. The one on July 11th is being hosted by the Small Planet Institute, and Anna Lappe will be a guest speaker there, along with some of the leaders from Kauai who are working on this pesticide issue. And then on July 12th, it will be held at the Community Food Funders from 11 to 1 p.m. So July 11th is in the evening and July 12th is during the day. Both are really worth coming out to. And then in the evening of July 12th, Stone Barns up in Tarrytown, New York. Stone Barns Center is hosting summer nights, three Thursdays coming up starting July 12th. The first one, Anna Lappe, will be the guest speaker, and it's Women for Food and Agriculture is the theme of these summer nights at Stone Barns. And if you haven't been to Stone Barns, where the Blue Hill restaurant is, it's a wonderful place. The Blue Hill Cafe will be open for you to get dinner if you'd like, and you can tour the farm. Wonderful evenings, only $20. I hope to be there, so if you're going, I will see you there. July 14th, there's a couple things going on. There's an open garden day at Perfect Earth Project out in East Hampton. And it's they're inviting us to join in on a toxin-free land care crusade with Edwina, who was a guest on my show last year. The Perfect Earth Project is really trying to make people aware of how to grow lawns without pesticides, and they're doing some great work out in the Hamptons. If you are out in that area, you want to check it out. Slow Food Nations is taking place again this year, July 14th and 15th, out in Denver, Colorado. A wonderful event. I was there last year, really worthwhile. Also on July 14th, the Sylvia Center is having their farm-to-table dinner. It benefits the Sylvia Center, but it's actually taking place at Catchkey Farm up in Kinderhook. And this is a fundraiser for the Sylvia Center that runs wonderful programs in the city on the Lower East Side all year long. And their farm is up in Columbia County, and they teach kids about growing and cooking, and it's a wonderful organization. So, and the farm-to-table dinner is a wonderful event, lots of fun, music, so definitely come check that out. NOFA New York has their open field sessions. So there's many of them going on. So I recommend going on to the NOFA New York website and finding out what open sessions they have coming up. I know they have one on July 19th at a dairy farm, High Meadows Farm in Hoosick Falls. So depending on where you are in New York will depend on whether you want to go to that. July 19th, there's a boycott taking place, a boycott for Wendy's. It's a march taking place in New York City at 280 Park Avenue near 49th Street at 5 p.m. And so many tomatoes, and we'll be discussing those later today with my guest, who will be coming on in a little while. The Moki workers, farm workers, they are a farm organization that is raising awareness about the plight of farm workers, and growing tomatoes has a real dark side, and we will be getting into that today. But the Farm Workers Alliance and the Moki farm workers are having a protest to try to get Wendy's to agree to pay more for each of their tomatoes. Right now, they are one of the holdouts in the fast food conglomerates who are not willing to pay a little bit more for their tomatoes and pay a fair wage to the farm workers. So that protest will be taking place July 19th, and we'll talk more about that later. And I just want to recommend you all go onto my website to check out all these events, because there's so many. But like I said, I don't want to take the time to go over all of them right now. So check those out. I have a great recipe that I want to share with you today. I made a tofu and broccoli in walnut sauce. And the walnut sauce was inspired by a dear friend of mine from the Republic of Georgia. And they eat walnuts all the time. And they make a walnut sauce that uses a spice that you can order online and you can probably find in some spice stores. It's called Kumeli Sunili. And it's spelled K-H-M-E-L-I-S-U-N-E-L-I, two words. And it just gives a great flavor to the walnut sauce. So you do want to get that. If you don't have that, you can add some spices like coriander and cardamom and get a similar flavor, but it's not the same. So you're going to start with 1 cake of extra firm organic tofu that you're going to cut into cubes, 2 tablespoons coconut oil, 1 onion sliced thin, 2 carrots cut into wedges, 2 celery diced, 2 teaspoons of the Kumeli Sunili spice that I just mentioned, 2 teaspoons of minced ginger, 2 teaspoons minced garlic, a bunch of broccoli cut into florets, 1 cup of frozen peas, 1/4 cup of sherry, and 1 tablespoon of tamari. For the sauce, you want 1 cup of walnuts that you can toast in a cast iron pan just for a few minutes, 6 cloves of garlic, 1 tablespoon tamari, 1 cup water, 1/4 teaspoon salt, 1 teaspoon of the Kumeli Sunili spice, 1 tablespoon pomegranate molasses, which is a wonderful, flavorful molasses that I use and sneak into recipes just to give it a little depth of flavor and a little sweetness, and it's delicious, and 1/4 cup of parsley. So you're going to start by laying the tofu out on a dry towel and covering it with another towel and just press lightly to absorb some of the water and remove the water before you stir fry it. Then you're going to heat 1 tablespoon of the coconut oil in the wok. And when that's hot, you're going to add the tofu and saute that until it's golden brown on one side. And so just don't, when you put the tofu in, make sure the oil's hot when you put the tofu in, and you want to sear the edge. So don't start stirring it right away. You can give the wok a little shake so it doesn't stick, but let that first edge get seared before you go to turn the tofu over. Once that's done, you can shake the wok to loosen the tofus and then turn them over so that the other side is getting golden brown. Then you're going to add the 2 teaspoons of the Kumeli Sunili spice to the tofu and let that cook for 3 minutes to allow the tofu to absorb some of that flavor. Then add the onions, the celery, and the carrots, the garlic, and the ginger, and saute that for another 5 minutes. Add the broccoli and cook that for another 5 minutes. Then add the sherry and the tamari, and that's going to just add the liquid to the wok and allow the vegetables to just steam really quickly and finish cooking. And you're going to do that until the vegetables are cooked all the way through. Meanwhile, while that's sautéing, you can make the sauce in a mini Cuisinart or a blender. And you're going to put all the sauce ingredients into the food processor and pulse it until it's smooth. And then you pour the sauce over the tofu and vegetables, and you can serve it with rice, noodles, or potatoes. In my picture, I served it with some side order of sweet potatoes that were delicious. And it comes together very quickly, and it's really delicious. I'll warn you, the color of the walnut sauce is not the most beautiful. It's kind of brownish, but it's worth it because the flavor is just so delicious. So you can garnish it with a little parsley just to brighten the colors a little bit, and that will help. And so I also want to share with you, I went to a literary luncheon this week up at the Inn at Pound Ridge. That's a John George's restaurant in Westchester. And the chef, Chloe Coscarelli, was speaking, and she was launching her new cookbook, which is called Chloe Flavor, Saucy, Crispy, Spicy, and Vegan. And she's a vegan chef. She's the vegan chef that won for her cupcake when she was competing against all these other non-vegan cupcakes, and her cupcake won. And I could see why. After eating all the food at this literary luncheon, it was just delicious. Every single dish was wonderful, plated beautifully. It was served family style, so you got to taste everything, and it was just so much fun. So anyway, check out her cookbook, Chloe Flavor. Also, I am participating in a grief retreat coming up the first weekend of August. And as many of you know who have been following me, I have lost a few family members in the last year, and it's been quite a difficult time for me. And some people I know, actually my niece, she is putting together a grief retreat up at the Himalayan Institute. And she found after her parents died, first her mother died, and then 10 months later her father passed away, she was just distraught, and she just wanted to go on a retreat. And there was no retreat center that really specialized in grieving. She didn't want to go and, you know, do a dance workshop or just a meditation with no guiding towards what she was going through. And so she has organized her first grief retreat up at the Himalayan Institute. She brought professionals to help create a wonderful weekend experience with yoga and hiking and journaling and circle work and a cooking demo by me. So if you have gone through any loss and would like to participate in a grief retreat, they actually have a funder who is funding the whole retreat. So you do not have to pay for the retreat. You just have to pay for the room and board, which is very reasonable. There's different price ranges, whether you want a private room or you want to share a room. So you can check that out on my website as well. But it's the first weekend of August. It's in the beautiful Pocono Mountains, and it should be a really wonderful weekend. And so if you are going through a trying time and processing grief, this might be a place you want to come to. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Barry Esterbrook. He is an investigative journalist and author of an award-winning book called Tomato Land, From Harvest of Shame to Harvest of Hope. This is actually its third edition. It first came out in 2011 and won many awards. And it is highlighting how the industrial agriculture system has ruined the tomato in all ways, in flavor, it's ruining the environment, and there's been a lot of labor abuse revolving around it, and that's what we'll talk about. And it actually was the inspiration behind the 2014 documentary Food Chains. And we'll talk about the Coalition of the Immokalee Workers, which is a farm worker community organization that is really mobilizing and trying to raise awareness about some of the labor abuse issues that take place with them. And that's what I was talking about with the Wendy's tomato protests that we'll talk about as well. Now, Barry did a lot of work growing up on a dairy farm and a commercial fishing boat as a young man, and that work actually convinced him that writing about food was a lot easier than actually producing it. And so now he lives on a 30-acre farm in Vermont, where he gardens, tends to a dozen laying hens, taps maple trees, and in an effort to reduce his alcohol footprint, brews hard cider from his own apples that no one except him likes, which is very convenient. Keeps it more in his pocket. And he's formerly a contributing editor to the late lamented Gourmet magazine. He's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, Mark Bittman's website. And so it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Barry Esterbrook. Barry, are you with me?
I'm with you. Hello.
Wonderful. How are you this morning?
It's a little damp up here, which is not unwelcome. We've had a pretty dry spring so far, so I think the farmers and certainly my garden are appreciating this day or two.
Well, that's how I felt when I saw that rain, because we've had little misty rain, but not a really good rain. And this rain was just so welcomed by me. It saved me hours of watering, so I'm happy. So anyway, so your book is just amazing, and obviously people are really relating to it because this is now its third edition. Can you share with me and my listeners what the inspiration was behind you writing this book?
Well, the inspiration, it's kind of embarrassing to talk about it right now because from my current perspective, but I was down in Florida doing a piece for Gourmet magazine that was strictly trying to address the question of why don't industrially produced winter tomatoes have any taste. I mean,
right.
We can put a man on the moon. Why can't we produce a winter tomato that has some flavor? And it was a frivolous, sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek article designed for the gourmet audience. And while I was down there doing this, the local newspaper ran a story about this awful slavery ring that had just been broken up. And, slavery ring, I thought, what? And as I read the article, it was slavery. I mean, these people were being, first of all, they weren't paid. They were kept captive, often locked up in old produce trucks and things like that at night. If they didn't work hard enough, they were severely beaten. So on and so forth. And a little further looking into it, I found out this wasn't the exception. It was common in the first decade of this century to have these arrests happening in the Florida tomato industry. And I sort of thought, well, why are you down here writing us, an article about flavor when the real story is these tasteless out-of-season tomatoes are produced in many cases by slaves. In fact, the district attorney down there who prosecuted many of these cases told me that in those days, if you ate a winter tomato, which is all of us, I guess, I try to avoid them, but if you ever did in your life, you ate a fruit picked by the hands of a slave. I came back, I did the silly story, and then I said to Ruth Reichel, my editor, terrific person, can I do this slave story for Gourmet? And she didn't hesitate. And so that started me looking into the Florida tomato industry.
Mm-hmm. When you first started the research, can you share with us some of the horrible conditions? I mean, you just touched on it, people being locked up in the back of produce trucks. But why didn't people just leave? How did they make them stay?
Well, first of all, at night they were locked up. I mean, in some cases they were kept up behind fenced enclosures that looked a lot like the sort of chain-link fence and concertina wire you see around a prison. In other cases, they were literally shackled in chains at night. Literally came out of the fields and were had chains put around their legs. Discipline was maintained by the ringleaders, and they were armed. And it was not uncommon for someone trying to get away to be shot dead and dumped in this a river that flows through that area. Not at all uncommon. They kept them that way, and they also kept them by saying, if you escape, we know where your family lives back in Mexico. and we have people there who will kill your family. So, you know, it was intimidation and physical restraint both. Like I say, this wasn't, you know, there's no euphemism for what was going on. It was slavery. Court records show that you could buy a human being in South Florida in 2007 for $350. That was the price of a human being, less than a purebred dog.
Wow. Wow, it's hard to believe. I mean, we're not talking about the beginning of the 19th century. We're talking about this century. That's
exactly.
Crazy.
No different from what was going on before the end of slavery in the United States. In fact, when these cases came to trial, the perpetrators were charged under the terms of the 13th Amendment, which is the amendment that ended slavery.
Mm-hmm. So since you first wrote this book in 2011, now we're talking 2018, so we're talking about 7 years. Can you share with us some of the changes that you've seen since you've written the first round of the book?
Well, the reason I came out with I did the third edition, was when I finished the research for this book, it came out in 2011, but it was 2010 when I finished the research. You know, all these conditions that I just described were still in place. And there was really, you looked around and you thought, how can this problem be solved? And in fact, in the intervening 6 or 7 years, the problem has largely been solved. And slavery was only the worst of a series of abuses. You know, even the best tomato workers had their, you know, wage theft, were made to work more hours than they were paid for. Sexual assault was the rule for women working in the fields. It was not the exception. Every woman would tell you stories of having been sexually harassed at very least. And it's like night and day. So it's amazing what has happened.
And what do you think caused the change? Just it coming out in public? Just the awareness? Or the organization of the Coalition of the Immokalee Workers? Or what actually helped make the change happen?
Well, back in the mid-1990s, early 1990s, a group of farm workers, and there were only a few of them, began to gather in the basement, in a meeting room in a local Catholic church, in the town of Immokalee. It's pronounced like broccoli, Florida, which is the largest migrant worker community in Florida. It's about 20,000 people. And most of them are in the tomato or citrus picking business. And they just started to work or meet periodically they knew this was not right, you know. They knew slavery wasn't right. They knew not being paid for hours they worked was not right. They knew the fact that they hadn't had an increase in 20 years in their salary was not right. And they started just at first it was just really gripe sessions, letting off steam, because, you know, there was nothing they could really do. Think of, you know, how would you go about curing such a huge problem, labor issues? These people, most of them didn't speak any English. Many, if not most of them, didn't have proper documentation. They were all dirt poor. They didn't give money to politicians. And yet they were going up against these huge industrial tomato farmers. You know, these aren't little, you know, farmers out in their fields.
Mom and pop, right.
Corporations. But they eventually, step by step, created a system whereby they themselves brought about the eradication of most of these problems we've discussed. At first, it was as simple as, you know, they realized that if one person went to a crew boss and said, "You haven't paid me in 3 weeks, I need to be paid," the crew boss would, you know, say, "Sure, come back tomorrow." But tomorrow would never come. It was always come back tomorrow. And then one day, this group just got up from their meeting, and there were about 10 of them, and they went to the crew boss and said, "You haven't paid our friend." And with 10 guys standing outside the door, what do you think happened? He got paid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they that there was, individually, they were powerless. But together, they could do things.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, the second thing they did was that they could generate publicity. They could harness media. And again, these are people who come from areas in Mexico where they're you know, there isn't ready access to newspapers and television, but they figured that out. They approached one farmer, one president of a farm company, and said, you know, "Would you at least talk to us about what's going on?" And he said, "I don't talk to my tractor. Why should I talk to you?" And that weekend, they had a little demonstration, rally, march, whatever you want to call it, in Immokalee, this town. And they all wore headbands that said, pardon my Spanish here, but the headbands said, "Yo no soy tractor." I'm not a tractor. And it turns out that the local TV station in Fort Myers, Florida, was there and ran pictures of all these farm workers wearing these headbands saying, "I'm not a tractor." And it got a lot of attention. It was picked up statewide. And so they realized, hey, you know, we can get things done together, and we can generate media. And then the third thing they did, and this was the key, or the final piece of the puzzle, was these giant tomato companies in Florida, and there's only about 8 or 10 of them that do the whole state, all of them multi-million dollar corporations. Well, you would never know their names, because they don't want to be brands. They want to be invisible. So you really had no way to publicly pressure them. But one of these workers said, "Well, what about the end users? What about the big grocery chains? What about the big fast food chains? They have a public image. They can be swayed by bad publicity." And so that's where they took their fight. They went to the first battle was with Taco Bell, which at the time was running that hideous advertisement with the chihuahua that talked with a really, you know, exaggerated Mexican accent, which they didn't, which would, was offensive in itself. But so they went after Taco Bell and slowly gathered support. At first, it came from a few university students at Florida State, University of Florida, but they were all connected to like-minded students through the internet, across the country. And so the movement began with college campuses. And Taco Bell, for years, had said, wouldn't even speak with the workers, until the point where these students got Taco Bell kicked off of 20 university campuses across the country. The students, said, "We don't want this outfit on our campuses." And so with 20 Taco Bell's executives were willing to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And what the workers, which now had a name, called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, they designed their own list of demands. These weren't, you know, union stewards doing it or do-gooders at some NGO off in New York or Switzerland. It was the workers themselves, these simple people, who said, well, this is what we want. We want absolute zero tolerance for slavery. You know, not such a huge demand when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we want zero tolerance for sexual abuse of any sort. Again, this is the level they were functioning at. And the list went on. We would like to have time clocks, punch clocks, somehow in the fields monitoring how much time we're there, because we can go there and spend 8 hours and only get paid for three. There's no mm-hmm. record. I mean, this was 7 or 8 years ago. Punch clocks were unheard of in the tomato industry. And it went on like that. And the ultimate request was, we would like 1 penny more per pound for the tomatoes we pick. Because their wages are based they're paid on a piece basis per pound. 1 penny more per pound. And it doesn't sound like much, but it was a 50% raise. You know, the difference between making $50 in a 10-hour day and making $80 in a 10-hour day. It was a huge difference to them because they were just mm-hmm. terribly poor, even though they worked their asses off. And so they said to Taco Bell, we want you to agree not to buy tomatoes, or to only buy tomatoes from growers who agree to these demands, these requests. And Wendy's said, okay.
Taco Bell.
So Wendy's is a whole other
story. We're still fighting for Wendy's.
Oh, we'll get to Wendy's later, I guess. But
as of right now, let me just say, Wendy's, as far as I know, is the only fast food chain that has not agreed to these demands. Is that correct?
So one by one, the other big fast food chains came aboard, kicking and squealing often, but came aboard. Wendy's is the only major holdout right now.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, certain big food service companies, the companies that provide meal service for universities particularly,
mm-hmm.
Bon Appetit, companies.
Aramark, Cisco. Mm-hmm.
They came aboard. Case of Aramark, they were kind of had to be with their arm twisted. Case of Bon Appetit Management, which is part of the Compass Group, they came aboard willingly because their students were demanding it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Whole Foods joined in early on of its own accord. And ultimately, Walmart, which is the biggest grocery store, you know, grocery selling company in the country,
joined,
of its own accord. And so all of a sudden, they had enough buying power, enough big buyers saying, we want these, we don't want slavery, we don't want sexual abuse, we do want an extra penny a pound, we do want, you know, these other things, punch clocks, simple things like shade, porta potties, water. None of this was available to them. And they got enough buying power that all of a sudden these big tomato companies had to say uncle and they came aboard. So that was several years ago. The big question was, well, will it work? You know,
mm-hmm.
Florida is over 400 miles long. There's thousands of tomato workers working in thousands of fields, you know, on thousands of acres all over the state. How can you? But they, again, the coalition created an independent third-party organization that called the Fair Food Standard Council that put in a monitoring system that proved extremely effective. There was a complaint mechanism, first and foremost, before any worker was allowed in the fields. They had to take a they had to go through an education program where they were told, here are your rights under the Fair Food Code of Conduct. Again, you have the right not to be sexually abused. You have the right not to be enslaved. You need to have punch clocks. You have the right to shade, to water. You have these rights. And so all of a sudden, every worker in the tomato fields knew they had these rights. They knew it before they didn't. Secondly,
That's huge. Game changer.
That's really huge because essentially, you know, when labor abuse occurs, you know, who's there? Well, the abuser and also the worker. And so all of a sudden, what the coalition will tell you is they basically had 30,000 monitors 24/7 in the field. People who knew their rights. And the bosses knew that the workers knew their rights. More important, right? Bosses knew that every one of these guys out there, people out there, have been through that program. And the second thing was, that's all well and good, but they set up a 24-hour grievance hotline. 24/7. It was monitored in Spanish, English, and Creole, Haitian Creole, the languages spoken, well, Spanish and Creole were the primary languages spoken by the workers. And so if you complained, action was taken. So you knew that, you know, before if you complained to the crew boss, you'd be fired. Because he was the end. There was nobody above him as far as the worker was concerned. He was the end of the road. Now you had this grievance system where you could say, this guy sexually abused me, and there would be a hearing, there would be evidence. And if it was true, the final leg was there were severe repercussions. Sexual abuse or harassment, verbal, you were given one strike. Actual physical sexual abuse, it was zero, zero tolerance, gone.
You know, it's amazing because Justin, you know, like you said, from your first book to the third, you know, to see that dramatic a change in only 7 years is huge. It really, you know, it's really quite remarkable. But Barry, before we go on, I want to take a couple minute break so that the studio can run their little promos things. And when we come back, I actually want to talk about what the way that they actually treat the tomatoes, because in the 7 years, I can't say that the winter tomato has tasted any better. So I'd love to talk a little bit about what they're doing in these tomatoes and why they're still so terrible. And maybe we can, in another 7 years, have better winter tomatoes. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking to Barry Esterbrook. Be right back.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
Heidi Bogosian, co-host of Law & Disorder Radio. Tune in Wednesdays at 5 p.m. to hear timely analysis on issues concerning civil liberties, privacy, the right to dissent, and even practices of torture by the U.S. government and private corporations. Our guests are leading authorities in their fields from around the country and sometimes internationally. They include authors, lawyers, activists, scholars, and many more. That's Wednesday at 5 p.m. right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
The Progressive Radio Network is a thinking person's network for our world's progressive visionaries and stakeholders and great thinkers to assemble on a commercial, free, and listener-supported network. Our provocative hosts speak freely and passionately on intriguing and urgent topics such as health and news and politics and women's issues and philosophy and more that directly impact our lives. Progressive Radio Network takes chances. Our voices and ideas are not always welcomed by corporate media, so Progressive Radio Network is a very important outlet for these great thinkers.
Dire frontline data is difficult to hear but necessary to face if we're to have any chance of changing the current course of industrialized, militarized civilization, which is pushing us at blinding speed toward near-term total global extinction. This is Dane Wigginton with the Global Alert News Hour, brought to you commercial-free by geoengineeringwatch.org, the largest and most visited website in the world on the subject of illegal and ongoing climate engineering operations that are threatening the entire web of life. Tune in to PRN Radio on Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time for an hour of the latest and most dire frontline breaking news on the most critical threats we collectively face.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest is Barry Esterbrook, and we're talking about his book, Tomato Land. And we were talking about the Fair Food Program and the Immokalee workers and how improved the conditions have gotten since his first book to his third edition, which just came out. But what we were just about to address is actually the quality of the tomatoes and the taste of the tomatoes, which has not improved. So, Barry, can you tell us why the tomatoes that are grown in Florida during the winter taste so bad and don't taste anything like the tomatoes we grow in our garden?
Well, I would say that the winter tomatoes, it's not so much the taste bad, although if they taste of anything, they taste bad, but they don't taste at all.
They don't taste at all, and they're also mealy. Very often they're mealy, and they're, yeah, they look beautiful, though.
at best, they're tasteless.
Right.
Well, the answer is simple. One farmer who was honest enough told me when I asked him that question, he said, "Barry, I don't get paid a plug nickel for flavor. I get paid for weight and size of tomatoes. So I want plants that put out a huge number of tomatoes, as most of which are a nice big size." That's what he wants. Flavor doesn't figure in. So if you're a plant breeder for commercial tomato production, if you're working at a university or at a seed company and you're a breeder, you don't breed for taste because no one's getting paid for it. You could have the tastiest tomato in the world, and if the next breeder's tomato produces more fruit, no one's going to buy your seeds. So for decades, breeders have been putting all of their focus on plants that produce a huge number of big fruits that are hard enough to survive transport. And that's really all that matters. Mm-hmm. And literally, this has just recently been discovered, the genes that are required to produce flavor in a tomato got lost for industrial tomatoes. They vanished.
Really?
No one was breeding for them. So you weren't, no matter what, you weren't going to get a tomato with any flavor. And so that's what's happened. I mean, the plant breeding is like doing a Rubik's Cube. You know, the first things are relatively easy. I want big tomatoes, okay. I want, you know, lots of them, okay. But as you go through the different sides of the cube, things take longer, are more complex, the trade-offs,
right.
and much more expensive. So why do that if you're not, you know, if you're a breeder, you're not going to get paid.
Uh-huh.
So it's,
well,
it's,
in your book, you also talk about, you know, the tomatoes in Florida, that they actually have to spray 8 times more pesticides, fungicides, and herbicides than the growers in California. Why is that?
Yeah, well, if you were going on the basis of biology and horticulture, Florida would be the last place. You would have to be stupid to try to grow tomatoes in Florida. First of all, tomatoes originally came from parts of Western South America, which are some of the driest places in the world. Rarely do they get rain. They love hot, dry weather. Look at how well they do in, say, Italy. If you look at your own garden here, what happens toward the end of a humid summer? Your tomatoes start looking pretty sad.
Mm-hmm.
And Florida is nothing if not humid. And everything that would eat a tomato, sicken a tomato, thrives in Florida. And the only way to get a crop in Florida is basically to wage chemical warfare, which is why you have that statistic that you quoted, 8 times as much chemicals as hot and dry California uses to produce the same amount of tomatoes on the same land. So if you planted a tomato in Florida and didn't do that, it would vanish.
Mm-hmm.
The pests are too prevalent. And you know, in the warm weather, they never go away. We curse our winter in the north, but it does kill off all the pathogens and bugs and stuff that are, you know, sort of sets the dial back to zero for the next season.
Right.
You don't have that information.
Well, you also talk about that they have to pick the tomatoes green and then gas them. And I assume that's the same both in Florida and California. And why do they do that?
Well, it's primarily a Florida thing. And the reason they do it is for shipping. So they pick the tomatoes and they say they're fully mature, just haven't turned red yet. But the problem there is you don't know. The picker doesn't know. You can't tell from the outside. And when a tomato plant, you know, its fruit gets ripe, the plant itself will send off gas, ethylene gas, and that will cause the fruits to get ripe, rosy red ripe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can take a green tomato and stick it in a warehouse, which is what they do, a hard green tomato. Stick it in a warehouse and expose it to seal the warehouse and fill it with ethylene gas, and those tomatoes will obligingly turn red, even though they may not be ripe. It's, so that even further, you know, if the tomato by chance had a bit of flavor, that would sort of take care of a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are they allowed to gas organic tomatoes too?
Most of the organic production, and it's very limited in Florida because it's so hard to do, they don't do that for marketing reasons. But it's a natural. The gassing sounds bad, but it's really the same gas that the plant would emit.
Right.
So I mean, the big problem there is you're making tomatoes look ripe that really aren't ripe. They really aren't vine ripe. But they are nice and hard. And you can control the amount of gas you give them. So, you know, if a tomato's only going up to Georgia, to the supermarket, you gas it almost perfectly ripe. If it's going to be going to New York City, you'd gas it a little. It'll be a little pinkish, so it would ripen, redden en route.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an old technology. And the trouble with the Florida tomato industry is they're kind of addicted to it. They've got huge buildings and infrastructure designed to handle what they call gas green tomatoes. And they are kind of, they can't get rid of that infrastructure. So it prevents them from going on to some of the equally tasteless but more recently developed tomatoes that can be picked when they're getting red.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, we are just about out of time. So there's so much more I want to ask you. But everybody who's listening, if you didn't get all the information you want, you can just have to read the book. So get the book, Tomato Lands, from Harvest of Shame to Harvest of Hope. You definitely want to get the latest edition because it has all the good new stuff in it. And Barry, thank you so much for joining me, and thank you for your work.
It was my pleasure, and, you know, in a few weeks, we'll all be eating the tomato type of tomatoes we should be eating, local.
That's right. I can't wait. I only eat them this time of year. I only want to eat ones that are grown in my garden or someone else's garden. So, anyway. Right. So everyone out there, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'll see you all again next week. And I hope I see you out at a march this weekend, June 30th. Bye for now.